Welcome to the First Things podcast. On this episode, the Vatican has released new guidelines regarding cremation. I'll talk with First Things editor Rusty Reno about the Catholic Church's traditional prohibition of the practice and why more and more people, including Catholics, are opting for it. Then, Jack Chick, creator of the Chick Tracts, died last week. Assistant editor Alexi Sargent will comment on the legacy of the evangelical comic book artist who sought to scare his readers to Jesus. Finally, just in time for Halloween, college administrators have drawn up their rules for culturally sensitive costumes. Senior editor Mark Bauerlein has the scoop in the New York Times. I'm associate editor Julia Yost. Thanks for joining us. On Tuesday, the Vatican's Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith published a new set of guidelines for cremation. If a Catholic chooses to be cremated, the ashes are to be stored in a church-approved place, a cemetery or crypt. They are not to be kept at home, nor scattered in nature, nor converted into jewelry. This instruction is a refinement of a rule change that came in 1963. Whereby the church gave limited approval to cremation, a practice that once had been illicit became licit, so long as it did not imply a denial of faith in the resurrection. In the decades since 1963, cremation has been increasingly popular in the West, including among Catholics. Some estimates have it overtaking traditional burial. In this context, it makes sense that the Vatican saw a need to elaborate its rules governing this practice. Rusty, can you explain the theological background here? Why has the Catholic Church traditionally opposed cremation?
It's a basic tenet of faith that we are resurrected in our bodies. And so the destruction of the body after death, it's counter-symbolic to the hope in the resurrection of the body. Now, obviously, you know, in the grave, ancient Christians knew that the body decomposes over time. But nevertheless, I think it's a very symbolically powerful thing to be buried intact, so to speak, because you are raised from the dead intact in Christ.
Since God is omnipotent, of course, he can put a burnt-up body back together again at the resurrection.
Just as a decomposed body.
Well, just as a decomposed body. And also, as with saints who, after their deaths, get chopped up and sort of sent around to different pilgrimage sites, right? I mean, all that stuff can come back together. And so along those lines, I heard once of a medieval abbey in which the monks' corpses were dismembered and then interred in several different places in the abbey grounds, precisely as an act of faith in the power of God to put it all back together again on the last day. So if you're thinking in these terms, you know, cremation doesn't seem per se antithetical to Christian teachings about the body, about death, judgment, and resurrection. But what's crucial, right, is the spirit in which it's undertaken. You know, what are the intentions being implemented, the beliefs being implemented? And most folks today surely are not thinking like medieval monks when they stipulate in their wills a desire to be cremated. So, Rusty, why do you think it is that people today, including Catholics, increasingly are opting for cremation over traditional burial?
Probably a number of factors. We should never discount cost. It's very expensive, actually, to have a traditional funeral and then to be buried in the graveyard. A lot of people don't make plans in advance of their death and acquire a plot. But there's also something appealing to us, I think, as moderns. We are very remote from death. Death is kept at a distance. It happens in the hospital or in the hospice. And so cremation is very, as a kind of sanitizing connotation to it. It seems purifying to be burnt up in our body after death. And so it's a way that we can limit in our imagination the contagion of death. I mean, dead bodies are in all cultures have many taboos associated with them, because we see the dead body as sort of already having crossed the boundary of life and death and into death, and so it becomes a symbol or a talisman or in some way an earthly representative of the power of death, which is quite frightening. And so I think cremation is a kind of reassurance, and I think that's one reason why the Vatican, rightly to my mind, is, although it allows for cremation, is very anxious about how it influences us spiritually. Because ultimately, it's the power, God's power of life as manifest in the resurrection of Christ from the dead. That is what protects us from the contagion of death. Nothing that we can do. And certainly not a kind of quasi-ritual of purification by fire. And so you see that in the Vatican's comments about cremation and undertaking it in the right spirit and so on and so forth. I'm not quite sure what they have in mind when they think of what the right spirit would be. Maybe out of necessity. You know, it's fine to do it out of necessity. Certainly the church has always allowed that out of necessity. I like graveyards. And there's something about, and the Cardinal Mueller in his comments talked about the danger of people keeping their ashes of loved ones on their mantle or something like that. That's absolutely forbidden. And Mueller speaks, I think, quite astutely and correctly about the way in which the dead are the property of the communion of the faithful. And so the catacombs in which early Christians worshipped in places like Rome were burial grounds. And so they would celebrate the Eucharist in these catacombs where the niches were where the bodies were buried. And you celebrate the Eucharist, which is the communal ritual of life, resurrection, the power of life, and a triumph over death amidst the dead. And it's a collective affirmation of God's power. And so the dead are actually constituents of the Christian community. In their death, they do not become lifeless. They endure the communion as members of the communion of the saints. That's why graveyards are, I think, it's a powerful thing. But you can put ashes in a niche, as they often now they have in graveyards, mm-hmm. columbariums they're called, and that preserves that dimension of a proper Christian understanding of burial.
I think there is something just terribly bad and morbid and just all around bad about keeping ashes in, say, a decorative urn on a mantelpiece, or, you know, the new thing is you get ashes compressed into a diamond and you can right. wear that around. You know, this reminds me of a Victorian practice, which was to cut the locks of hair from the dead
yes.
and turn that into jewelry, you know, and wear a brooch with somebody's hair braided on it.
It's a quite understandable natural impulse to try to preserve life through memory.
Yeah.
And so the person is with you in memory through the preserving of this artifact from them, or maybe some memento. And the Christian claim is no. They are preserved in the promise of new life in Christ. You know, they're not preserved through any actions that we take.
Right.
And so to have the lock of hair in the little locket is a sign of a distrust that the dead are really present with us in the communion of saints.
Yeah, it seems, you know, this notion that we can sort of beat death in some way by converting corpses into decor or into other kinds of consumer products seems a very weak effort at triumphing over death.
Yeah, you do what you can.
You do what you can.
If you don't believe.
You know, but this seems very consistent with, you know, what you've said, Rusty, about, you know, our desire to avoid the fact of death. We find it very easy to do that. Our elderly tend to be segregated. We hand them over to geriatric caregivers, experts. And we have these sort of mostly unformulated fantasies about how medicine is going to extend life so that we don't have to confront these things. And I think you see these ideas implemented also in funeral planning, even when it is a fairly traditional burial. Mm. You know, increasingly people want to say that this funeral is not going to be the commemoration of a death, it's going to be the celebration of a life. You know, and so we're not here to talk about death. We're not going to think about that too much. I'm told that the most popular song to play at American funerals these days is Frank Sinatra's My Way. And I hope that fact is apocryphal, but I fear that it's not.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. It probably is true. I do, one of the most powerful aspects of going to a Catholic funeral is the celebration of the Eucharist in the context of the funeral. And I used to go to daily mass at the noon mass at the cathedral in Omaha when I lived in Omaha. And you know, you pull up and there's all these cars parked in the hearse and you go, oh geez. So it's normally 25 minute mass is gonna be 45 or 50 minutes. And I always would kick myself because of course, one of the corporal works of mercy is to bury the dead. So it's actually a blessing to be able to be present at another person's funeral because you can be with them, supporting them in prayer. But one of the most powerful experiences is you go past the casket to receive communion. So yeah. you can touch the casket pretty much as you're receiving communion. So I always think of that's the way the church puts a stick in the eye of death, saying you don't get the last word. And that's so much more powerful than these kind of feeble efforts to pretend that a funeral is about life by remembering a person's past, which is perfectly fitting to remember them and to cherish those memories. But to try to use that as a counter to the power of death, no. Death swallows all that up. We need a supernatural consolation and not these natural consolations, which are really quite feeble in the face of death.
Do you think there's something Gnostic sometimes about cremation? Just sort of, I'm liberated from my body now?
No, I don't think so. I think, that may be a factor in some instances, but I think it's more characteristic. I think it's more the feeling of purification that, I mean, the contagion feeling, and this is the ultimate taboo, death, it's the ultimate contagion, it's the ultimate impurity. And so, wow, just the flames of cremation are, one has a hope of sort of completely silencing, if you will, or destroying that contagion, so I think psychologically for us, we think about that in a way that although obviously you're already dead, so you don't need to be preserved from that contagion, but nevertheless, we never think of ourselves as death. I don't believe we can really imagine ourselves as dead. We can imagine somebody like us dying, but we can't imagine ourselves as dead. So we see ourselves at our own funeral suddenly faced with this terrible contagion of death. One of the interesting features of the ancient Roman world is that because they recognized that death had a contagion, that all the burial plots were outside of the cities. And when Ambrose was involved in a battle with the empress, whose name I can't remember, over doctrine, I think she was an Arian, one of the things that he did was to translate the remains of various martyrs from these suburban burial plots into the city of Milan and had them reinterred in the catacombs of the Cathedral of Milan. And that was a way of mobilizing the power of the dead. So instead, far from being a contagion, these remains represent sanctity and the power of life. And I think that's where Christianity has a very transformative influence on the antiquity's imagination about death. Because in antiquity, the dead could be nothing more than terrible reminders of our mortality.
Right, because death was the end.
Death is the end, it's the ultimate disintegration. It's a reminder that all is flux, nothing is permanent. From dust you have come, and to dust you shall return. Now that's an element of the Christian message, a reminder of the finite nature of our span, But that finitude is then encompassed by God's everlasting covenant with us. And so this reimagining or this transformation of the dead from a symbol of something that is a symbol of our disillusion into something that's a symbol of God's power of life that Ambrose was exploiting, that was a feature of the catacombs. You want to have the dead as close as possible because they are, that in them we participate in God's power of life because they are sort of already born again in the Lord. So sometimes it's a traditional Christian way of talking about how, you know, when my mother died in 2004, that she, you don't say that she was died in 2004, she was born in the Lord in 2004, and that we enter into our supernatural destiny. So I think it's kind of an interesting thing, and I think cremation does reflect a reversion of our spiritual imaginations to a more ancient pre-Christian way of thinking. It's something that we have to, it's a power we have to silence or in some way placate or keep at a distance. And so that there, you know, that's an element. And it's so much more sanitized, you know, the urn with the ashes. I don't think it's nearly as threatening as
it's been
open
processed.
Casket funeral. This is very, I think I find open casket funerals very affecting, often difficult, especially if they're from people I knew.
They're estranging, they're eerie. You know,
yes.
You can see this is the body of my loved one, and
but
it's
they're
not
there anymore. No, they're dead.
Yeah,
they're really dead.
There's something very challenging
yes.
about an open casket. I think.
So, so it makes death more real to us. But then, of course, then the Christian message about its impotence. That death seems all powerful, but it in the Christ's resurrection, death is shown to be impotent. Not powerful, not all powerful. Death shall have no dominion. Oh, death, where is thy sting? Says St. Paul. So I think there's something important in that dynamic where you really confront it in the open casket, and then you, during the actual funeral, you re-encounter the message of salvation in a much more heightened way. The light in the darkness is much more powerful. A lot of priests say that funerals are very important times for people to hear the Christian message who have fallen away from the faith. That it's the time when we're, if you will, open to that message because we're confronting these sort of the stakes. What's at stake? Sure, the ultimate stakes.
Jack Chick died last Sunday at the age of 92. He was the originator of the Chick Tracts, 3x5-inch evangelical pamphlets, 20 pages long, comic booklets telling stories of spiritual warfare. The hero is always a Christian. The enemies are, in different tracts, Catholics, Mormons, Muslims, Satanists, secularists, gays, abortionists, ecumenists, believers in the theory of evolution, kids who play Dungeons and Dragons, kids who read Harry Potter, and kids who dress up for Halloween. These sinful souls either convert and meet an illuminated Jesus in heaven, or don't and meet a gleeful devil in hell. The tracts always close with a standard sinner's prayer. Chick Publications claims over 250 titles, with over 800 million copies distributed in over 100 languages. The tracts have been handed out with candy at Halloween. They've been left in truck stop restrooms. They have made Chick, we are told, the most widely read theologian in the world. The Chick tracts are criticized, of course, for their polemics, which are both crude and conspiratorial. They're also valued and collected for their offbeat artistry. Here to comment on the cultural significance of the passing of Jack Chick is First Things assistant editor and comic book enthusiast, Alexi Sargent.
I think Jack Chick himself put it best, Julia. The real question is, do we want to reign with Christ forever, with a beautiful mansion, or stick with Satan's popes, receive the mark of the beast, and spend eternity in a lake of fire. When you put it like that, the choice is pretty clear, I feel. No, the genius of these treks comes down to that sharp binary. It's a black and white world in more senses than one. And Chick makes the most of his cartoonish medium with a sort of semi-grotesque art style that's hard to look away from, even when you're like, what is he doing? The treks have a lot of fans who sort of collect them for their ironic and kitsch value. On the comic book and pop culture podcast, War Rocket Ajax, the hosts have a segment where they rank every comic book story of all time. And when someone asked them to rank Dark Dungeons, the famous Chick tract, where Chick condemns the demonic spirits that undergird the role-playing game Dungeons and Dragons, they said, well, we disagree with Chick on his politics, and we feel he's wrong in everything he critiques. But this is a very enjoyable comic to read. I would read this again before I read Alex Ross's Kingdom Come, for example. So we'll have to rank it pretty high on our list of every story ever.
Could you tell us about a classic anti-Catholic tract?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a particular Chick tract called Mama's Four Daughters, I believe, Mama being the Catholic Church, where Chick alleges that the church, in the course of its long life of fomenting conspiracies and working with Satan to entrap souls, was the originator of four other forces in the world: Islam, communism, Nazism, and Freemasonry, which in some ways gives the church a great deal of organizational credit, perhaps more than she even deserves. I mean, certainly when Chick makes the claim that the Catholic Church has a secret supercomputer in the Vatican that records the names of all Protestants for the sake of the coming Antichrist so they can more easily be rounded up to receive the mark of the beast, he's crediting the church with more worldly savvy than I think sometimes we see evident in her bishops and hierarchy. But maybe we're misjudging them. Maybe Chick understands the true intelligence of our Catholic overlords. Who am I to know? I'm but a lowly Catholic misled by their claims of having the body of Jesus when all they have is a death cookie that's a false idol derived from Babylonian Baal worship.
Could you tell us a little bit about his critiques of Halloween and RPGs, by which we don't mean Robert P. George, but rather role-playing games?
Yes, absolutely. So Jack Chick is responsible, according to some of my friends who grew up evangelical, for them being banned from participating in trick-or-treating or other Halloween traditions, because Chick promulgated the idea, which has now been revealed as largely a myth, that Halloween was derived from Druidic practices and somehow has a historical connection to the occult, when in reality, Halloween comes from All Hallows' Eve. It progressed through Mischief Night into the tradition of trick-or-treating through the action of the Boy Scouts of America. Chick wants us to believe that Halloween is a night of widespread demonic activity and, possibly even poisoned candy. He wants us to think Halloween is a time of great danger. And that way he, echoes and reinforces the various moral panics that have sprung up around the holiday. But there's sort of a love-hate relationship with Halloween that Chick has, because he had to clarify at some point in his career that evangelicals, fellow Christians who read his tracts, should be willing to give out candy on Halloween because they can slip the tracts in with the candy. To his credit, he doesn't say, don't give out candy and give out tracts instead. He says, no, children like candy, but while they're receiving their candy, they can also receive the gospel.
I mean, that's his MO, right, with the Chick tracts, period. It's sort of, give people something that, especially children, something that they do like, comic books, and slip the gospel in with it. And I guess this gets us to an interesting question, right, about the aesthetics of the Chick tracts. They are remarkably grotesque, I think was a word you used. They're lurid. They're not wholesome looking. And yet
So that's an interesting tension, I think, between the content and the vehicle that's delivering it.
Yeah, I think on the surface that's the tension. I think at heart it's in alignment, because Chick lives in a very nightmarish world. We are sinners in the hand of an angry God. We're teetering on the edge of hell. And even when he depicts Jesus in the tracks, it's often as a massive faceless giant sitting in judgment. So there's a sense that the whole world is fraught with spiritual danger, and even the smallest things like dressing up for Halloween or playing a role-playing game are playing into Satan's claws. The path is very narrow indeed. And so the grotesquerie and kind of exaggerated, ugly, cartoonish human forms in the Chick tracks illustrated by Chick, and some of the kind of queasy sensuality in the Chick tracks illustrated by the trained artist he brought in, Fred Carter, who illustrated some of the later tracks. Both of these things kind of reflect the dangerous and slightly horrific world that Chick lives in. One other point about Halloween that strikes me is, even if Halloween were understood by Chick to be just the eve of All Saints Day, he would find it abhorrent, because saints for him are inherently idolatrous. No one in the Chick tracks who claims to have grown in holiness is proven righteous. They're condemned instead for works righteousness. Whenever the preacher Mr. Wonderful dies in the track about the dangers of ecumenism, he is condemned to hell for flirting with heresy by entertaining ambitions to unite various Christian denominations. That is wicked. It's wicked to use Bibles that are not the King James Version. There's almost no escaping wickedness. We just have to say this sinner's prayer, but there's no sense that the sinners can, by God's grace, move on to becoming saints. And so All Hallows Eve, just as abominable as the Devil's Night.
Could you tell us something to situate Jack Chick within the history of comic books, maybe particularly around these questions of taste and luridness in the comic horror genre?
Absolutely. The thing that I was reminded of when we started talking about the grotesquerie of the Chick tracks is a famous moment from comic book history that I really enjoy, which was during one of the first moral panics about comic books in the 1950s. Bill Gaines, who published horror and crime comics, was brought before the Senate Subcommittee on Juvenile Delinquency that were investigating the potential link between lurid and grotesque content in comic books and youth misbehavior and crime, seeing whether the comic books were inspiring waves of juvenile delinquency. And he was cross-examined by people who were waving copies of horror comic books and saying, is this appropriate? Is this in good taste? As they pointed to a cover depicting a man holding a bloody axe and a decapitated head. And Bill Gaines' calm and assured response to, do you think this is in good taste, was, yes, sir, I do, for the cover of a horror comic. There was the sense there that the genre considerations of horror made something grotesque appropriate because it's a accurate advertisement for the chilling story found within its pages. And Jack Chick's work is also horror. Jack Chick's world is full of horrific things. And questions of good taste are altered by that fact. Is Jack Chick's work in good taste? Well, it's full of absurd conspiracies and allegations of the most preposterous and malicious sort. But is that in good taste for the type of scared straight comics that he wants to write? Perhaps it is. Perhaps it is.
Let's conclude with a nice word for Jack Chick.
Here's what I have to admire, right? Even despite, his opposition to the church that I belong to, I have to admire his evangelistic spirit. He converted to this form of born-again fundamentalist Christianity and thought that the correct thing to do would be to convert others, which, from his worldview, totally correct, right? If if what one has to do to be saved is pray this particular prayer, he should be spreading that prayer as widely as possible. He was too shy to talk to people in person, which I find charming. You know, he's a mysterious figure outside of his tracks. He doesn't give interviews because he's socially awkward. But he came up with the idea of creating these comic book tracks by looking at the methods of the Chinese Communist Party and spreading its ideology, and thought, that is a way that I, a shy person, could spread the gospel and save souls from hell. And that at least is admirable. The fervor there, the creativity, and the overcoming of shyness. I may think his methods are misguided to the point of delusion, but I have to admire his mindset.
It's Halloween again. Mark Bauerlein has a piece in the New York Times reminding us that this is the scariest time of year for college administrators. We all remember the horror show on the Yale campus 1 year ago. Erica Christakis was an administrator of Yale's Silliman Residential College and a lecturer in early childhood education. In October, she sent a blast email advising the student residents of Silliman to remain calm in the face of culturally insensitive Halloween costumes. On Halloween, suggested Christakis, perhaps it was okay for people to be a little bit inappropriate or provocative or, yes, offensive. American universities were once a safe space not only for maturation, but also for a certain regressive or even transgressive experience. Increasingly, it seems, they have become places of censure and prohibition. Christakis's email had an effect opposite the one she had intended. Students were triggered. On the main quad, they surrounded her husband, also a professor and administrator, and shrieked at him about microaggressions. Because of the Christakis's, Silliman College was no longer a safe home. The Christakis's have since left Yale, and who can blame them? Mark, your piece for The Times takes stock of the situation 1 year later. What seems to have been the effect of this episode and of others like it?
The thing to remember about college campuses and the administrators who run them at the selective schools, especially those schools that have a lot of wealth to them, is you do not want bad publicity and you do not want to face litigation or any conflicts with any government authorities. You just want to preempt problems before they happen. That's what a good bureaucrat does. And so what universities have done is seen the national embarrassment of Yale, and Yale did devote $50 million to yet another in a long line of diversity initiatives over the years, and they don't want those troubles to happen on their watch either. And so you do what a good college administrator does. You create programs. By programs I mean guidance. You make posters. You put out the word to students in advance. It's Halloween. Be careful. Think about what is offensive. Some of them issued posters that show pictures and say, why is this offensive? It's simply offering, be polite, be thoughtful, be sensitive, but they really do cross the line into forms of thought control and speech control. And what you said about college being a place for hijinks, right? Antic behavior, the stakes are too high now for schools to let that happen when you've got Title IX issues, Title VII issues, and again, litigation and bad publicity taking place. They're going to be a little more controlling in that soft guidance fashion in advance, although they do contain some threats. For instance, the head of students at Tufts University encouraged any students, if they see anything offensive, to report it, and there will be a full investigation, and then she promises disciplinary sanctions for any student. So it's a warning out there. And they're developing something I showed you, the SCREAM poster, the SCREAM program. This is at...
It's at UMass Amherst. So I should tell our listeners that SCREAM is an acronym. It stands for Simple Costume Racism Evaluation and Assessment Meter. And so the instructions are follow the flowchart and ask yourself the questions until you're led back to a threat level score. And so the questions are things like, Is your costume a person or a thing slash idea? Is the person of your own race? Do you have to wear heavy makeup or a mask for this person to be recognizable? Are you trying to be funny? Would you feel comfortable having a picture of you in your costume widely distributed, say, broadcast on national TV? And so based on your answers, the flowchart will direct you to a threat level from low, your costume is unlikely to offend people of other races slash ethnicities, to guarded, to elevated, to high, to severe, your costume is guaranteed to offend, and wearing it will likely lead to real implications for you and or others. Mark, thoughts?
Well, I think that we should all be very careful in what we say, and we all should be highly sensitive to how other people might feel. And we're going to agree with Chris Rock and Jerry Seinfeld that a college campus is no place to make jokes. So, now, this is all ridiculous, right? These are surface phenomena taking place. I mean, whoever devised this scream poster is trying to micromanage, right, human relations, which can't be micromanaged in any practical way. You're going to get things exploding now and then. You pile all these 19-year-olds together, you put them in dorms, you know, you add alcohol and music, and you're going to get difficult episodes. Now, on the student side, we've got a different issue, I think. Why are these 20-year-olds, or at least some portion of them, even a small portion, why are they so hypersensitive? Why have they been so ginned up with the idea of offense taking? Why not just shrug it off? I attribute it to a few things. One, we do have an identity politics regime very strong on college campuses today. We've got a broad cultural phenomenon of grievance and victimhood. This is our sacred issue. It's available now for any 19-year-old who is having emotional problems. You know, 19-year-olds are going to college for the first time. They're away from family, from friends, from home. They have sexual relationships that don't work out. They feel rejected and miserable. School is harder than they thought at the selective schools. These kids were stars in their high schools. They were going places. They're very keyed up with the achievement culture. They find they're having a hard time competing with the other kids. Organic chemistry is too much for them, and so pre-med is out. A lot of humiliation goes along with that. If you are someone who can take that inner turmoil and find a place for it and give it a rational course, you can generalize your personal condition. You can make it a political condition. And it does take rational form, and there's a great satisfaction in being able to do it. There's a relief. It's not really about Halloween costumes. This is a displacement of other things. Now, unfortunately, the college administrators do not provide students with moral grounds that help them deal with a lot of the moral and emotional chaos of youth culture, of life in the dormitories and the fraternities. They don't teach students, this is the kind of person you should become. We've got a lot of talk about a success and achievement, but we don't have a path of moral growth into gentlemen and ladies. Those terms sound reactionary and patriarchal and puritanical.
So the campuses have been evacuated of traditional moral norms. I mean, we all recognize that. And so, you know, the role of administrators should be to set a kind of positive example for students, you know, give them some guidelines that are going to help them make sense of their experience and conduct themselves in a way that is not harmful to themselves and others. And so administrators are taking a certain role in that, but they're doing it in just the most superficial way, correct?
Right. It's not a positive moral condition that they are supposed to mature, develop into, it's all negative constraints. Like, at every step of a sexual encounter, you must obtain consent.
Right.
Okay. Don't do this. Don't do that. The Halloween masks are always about restrictions,
right?
Prohibitions, because the campus is a liberal place, and one of the things that liberalism says is we will not judge one another on our private leisure choices as long as we're all sort of doing it without coercion. It's kind of a hands-off attitude they have, but of course, this opens the way precisely for the moral and emotional chaos that the students feel, and they need it. 19-year-olds need boundaries, limits, they need norms, and they'll make them for themselves.
Right, and that's one of the things that's very interesting to me. It seems like a lot of these prohibitions that are promulgated by administrators are just simply, they're the prohibitions that the most vocal students are asking for.
You know,
because the
right.
rules that the students want to set for themselves, because the adults aren't setting them, so the students will. And the rules they want to set for themselves are the ones that are going to keep them comfortable and unoffended and so on.
Right, it's a place where they can make a clear line between right and wrong, a clear line between propriety and impropriety. They're drawing lines. They're 19 and 20-year-olds, so they're going to draw the wrong lines.
Right.
They're going to use the wrong occasions, the wrong pretext for drawing the line. But I actually take, however ridiculous and totalitarian they sometimes sound, I take this as arising out of a fundamental human yearning for clarity and decency, and some elders who will pass along to them distinctions of taste and goodness. They want that, and we're not giving it to them.
Well,
college campus.
One man is fighting the good fight, right? So, Mark, you, of course, are tenured in the English department at Emory. And in the NYT piece, you set this scene. You say, walk through a crowded cafeteria and curse words pop up gratuitously among students as if vocabulary has failed them. When I say, hey, ease up on the language, okay? They look at me with incomprehension, not realizing they've said anything offensive. And I love that anecdote because it's such a great Mark Bauerlein dad on campus moment. I'm sure there's no other professor at Emory who bothers to tell students to clean up their language in the cafeteria.
I was in the library a while back, and I hear some kids talking behind me, and I just hear a young woman say, I mean, what the, you know what? And I turn around and said, hey, this is a library. And there were about five or six people there, guys and girls. This is a library. None of that. And again, there was just this blank look on their face because it's almost as if they didn't quite know what I was talking about because it's so routine in their lives. That's one. And two, no one tells them, knock this off. I mean, they're not bad kids. They're not, but they swim in this world of the F word. And I tell students, you know, in class, when this comes up, you hear about their language, I say, you do know that if you talked this way, you know, not that long ago, you'd be hustled off the stage, all right? You couldn't talk this way on a bus. You couldn't talk this way in a public place. You couldn't talk this way in a cafeteria. There would be several people who would be ushering you out in many of these public places, if women or children, women and children are present in particular. So when we don't tell them, you know, a psychologist once told me, even with her patients, she said, you have to tell a patient when he's doing something wrong. You can't just explain everything without getting any moral judgment about it. No, you are aware. We can talk about why you're doing something. We can go into the etiology of it. But what you're doing is wrong. That's the that's the moral side that we have lost. And it's hurting. It hurts them. I mean, even if they disagree with me, at least I'm giving them something meaningful against which to rebel.
That's all for this episode of the First Things podcast. Thanks to my colleagues, Rusty Reno, Mark Bauerlein, and Alexi Sargent. Thank you, listeners. Happy Halloween. And stay safe out there.